This is Seattle, Washington, June 11, 1988. I propose to tape a discussion with Erling Sanis concerning the organization, the Teamsters Union, North Dakota, South Dakota, parts of Iowa, 1937, 38, 39, and 40. Sanis did not call June 11th. I will wait tonight, which is June 18th. He has not written, so I assume he may call tonight at 8 o'clock. If so, the date on this tape will be June 18, 1988, instead of June 11, 1988.
Dinner. or 12 of them now.
If they take Cannon and right Cannon, they're all right. But if they start to right foreign, they're in trouble.
Why do?
If they let, you know, Cannon's works write what Cannon wrote, transcribe that.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But Cannon was a pretty goddamn able writer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Very good.
And he could write with humor. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I sent you a copy of him and Matt Shackman or not. Now, I placed that when they were staying at the Summit Hotel in Minneapolis.
Uh-huh.
And that had to be in the late July of 1934.
Shockman's papers are at the Tamarack Library.
Yeah, you see, now, I wanted to make one thing that's kind of clear it up. When you asked me about my experiences with the Wobblies in North Dakota,
yeah,
that wasn't my first experience. See, my stepdad was pretty knowledgeable about the Wobblies. He'd been involved in his earlier days when he was bumming around the country.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of his friends had come to the house and they would talk and everything. So I had a little background of the Wobblies long before, but you asked me a specific question about when did I bump into them in North Dakota, as I recall.
I guess I just assumed that was your first contact.
Oh, no. No, the old man and some of his friends, there were two or three of them. One was a big old carpenter, a Norwegian carpenter, and he had a funny name, Tiestedt or something. I can't, it started out TJ or something like that. And he was quite a Wobbly himself.
It wasn't T-Bone Slim, was it?
No, it wasn't T-Bone Slim. I don't know about him, who he was, or nobody else seems to know much about him either.
I know.
Huh?
His name comes up every once in a while.
Yeah, it does. You know. And Jerusalem Slim, his name comes up too.
Oh.
You know who they call Jerusalem Slim?
No.
That was Christ.
Oh.
That's who they call Jerusalem Slim. Yeah, that was a Wobbly name for Jesus Christ. When they'd want to talk about Jerusalem Slim, you know what they were talking about.
I see. Have you heard the latest on Joe Hill? I get the Wobbly paper.
I do too. I've got the latest issue out in my truck. I haven't unrolled it yet.
Okay, I won't tell you as long as you have, but there's an article in there about Joe Hill.
Yeah?
They found some of his ashes in the FBI headquarters in Washington.
His ashes?
Yeah. See, when he was executed, he provided in his will that his body would be returned to Chicago and cremated.
Yeah.
And half of his ashes were to be buried in Chicago at that cemetery. And the other half were to be sent to various places in the United States and around the world and so on.
Yeah, somewhere to go to Sweden, I thought.
And apparently the FBI intercepted the envelope that contained a small amount of the ashes like
that. Well, when could that have happened? There was no FBI at the time that he was executed.
Well, it was the Bureau of Investigation, is what it was called then.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's the forerunner of what we
call. Well, the...
But J. Edgar was running that office too, you know.
Was at the time that, Joe Hill was killed?
I can't remember the year that Hill was executed.
Oh, Christ, no. I'm not going to argue with you if they said that in the
1915
paper.
1915 and 1920, I think.
I don't think he was there that early.
Well?
See, it was they were attached to the Department of Revenue, the Internal Service.
Yeah, but I've got papers in my file. And
well, I'm not going to quarrel if you've got the dope, but I fixed them as being attached to the Bureau of Internal Revenue.
See, I did some work on Kate Richards O'Hare.
Yeah.
You probably remember her, the deaf socialist. And she was sentenced in federal prison here in North Dakota.
Yeah.
For 5 years. And for making a speech out at Bowman.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1917. And at that time, J. Edgar Hoover was in the Bureau of Investigation then.
He was?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Gee, I didn't think he was that old.
Well, he was there.
1916?
Yeah.
He'd had to been 30 years old then. Was he born that early?
I don't know, Jack. I really don't.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm just going by. The old son of a bitch had never been born. There's a job he done on me and the rest of us and the whole American left, that dirty bastard.
Yeah. Hmm? Well, read that article in the latest issue. You'll really enjoy that.
About, yeah.
About how they, you know, they've had these ashes all these years.
Oh. Well, that's not all they got all these years.
Well, Jack, to get back to North Dakota, so you were, came out here the first time with Farrell in January of 35, as I recall, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we drove out together, Farrell and I, in Farrell's car.
But before that, you had mentioned to me something about delivering the first truck of beer to North Dakota.
Yeah, well, Farrell wasn't around then.
Yeah.
I didn't know Farrell.
That would have been in 33 or 34?
1933. Now, I was working at that time for a trucking company, and we were hauling beer out of Schmidt's Beer Brewery in St. Paul. And the brewery, the beer, this contractor, this trucking contractor, had a contract with Valley City Wholesale Grocery. And they also had a hookup in Bismarck. We used to deliver into Bismarck, North Dakota. And we went into Mandan over across the river there. And where else did we go once? We took a load into Glendive of groceries now. But when beer first come back in April of 1933, we drove a load of beer into Jamestown, North Dakota. And we were going to deliver it there to a grocery company. Now, it was part of the, well, I don't know exactly, I can't recall now, but it was part of the operating apparatus of that Valley City Wholesale Grocery. They operated under, with different things. Well, when the beer would become, there was something in the state of North Dakota that they had to have a special session like they did in many states to handle that. Now, it was illegal to transport beer. As I recall, they told us it was illegal to transport beer in the state of North Dakota. That is, you couldn't unload it there. You could haul it through and everything. You could have all you wanted. Well, here we were. We had this, and the high sheriff come down, and he informed the grocery company that if they attempted to unload that truck, he would arrest them. Well, they told us to go to a hotel, and there was a couple of Greek restaurants there in Jamestown. We went over one on the railroad tracks there on the main street. There was a trucking company there, Schneider, I guess, was the name of it. And we went over there, and we said, where's a good place to eat? And they told us to go over, and we went and got a room in a hotel. We ate, and we went back to the truck, and it was parked alongside the street, out in front of this wholesale house, this grocery warehouse. And we told them they wanted to know where we were, and we told them what hotel we were going to be in. Well, a couple of hours we went up and we went to sleep. We'd driven out from Minneapolis this was after dinner already, about around noon or after dinner. And a guy, they put a call in for us, for one of us to come over. So I went over. I told my partner, you stay here, you sleep. I'll go over and see what's going on. Well, I went over and they asked me if I could back the truck up alongside of the warehouse. I said, sure. So I backed it in and I parked it. And then they proceeded to get some carpenters. And they built a kind of a lean-to with 2x4s and that corrugated metal or plywood or something. And they built a shed around that truck. And they said, now this is our warehouse. And that's the way they unloaded that first load of beer there. Yeah, that's the way they got around it. Yeah, they built a goddamn thing. They you see, it was legal to have the beer on the, so we unloaded. And when we got unloaded, we started back for the city. And we stopped and picked up some cream for, Bridgman Russell Cream, and we took it into, I guess it was Holmes Dairy in St. Paul. And by the time when we got back in, we didn't get any more beer. We got a letter for a load of condiments for the Jimtown Nut House. They got a giggle factory out there. They've got an insane asylum or something in Jamestown. So we brought out a load of condiments, about 12 ton of jelly and from, what the hell was it, Wheeler Manufacturing or something there on Hiawatha Avenue. So it was a week or 10 days before we got another load of beer to go out there. And in the meantime, they'd got something straightened around and we didn't have any more trouble. And that's the saga of the first load of beer that I know about in the Jimtown, North Dakota. I think it was the first load.
I'm sure you're right, John.
Huh?
I'm sure you're right.
Now, I can't tell you exactly what time that was. It was in the early spring, May, or whatever. But that's what I remember about that. And that's just about the way I recall it. They made a little lean-to around the goddamn truck, so it wasn't out in the open. Didn't take the carpenters long to nail a goddamn make a 2x4. You know, our truck was only 35, 40 feet long, and all we had to do was stick up 15, 20 pieces of plywood with some 2x4s, and that was all locked in. Well, we had a full load, I imagine, when we probably had 10, 12 ton, we had a full load on, 24,000, maybe at least. Now, those days, you could only haul a certain amount of weight. And, I think the frost boil law was still on. You could only have a certain amount of weight. You know, the frost boil law, you know about that. You only could have a certain amount of weight at that time of the year. No, it was in May. It couldn't have been. But we had everything we could get on that rig.
What was the name of the firm that you were driving for?
Well, I think it was Black Hawk Motor Freight is what they called it.
Black
Hawk. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad now to get back to Fargo in 35, then January 35. You ever remember a man by the name of William Ballou, Jack?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Can you tell me about him?
You're talking about the old professor?
Well, I think he was a Unitarian minister.
Was a minister? But I thought his name, wasn't his name Scott Ballou?
William is what I have.
Yeah, well, that's probably it. He was, man. I thought he was a teacher.
Well, you could be right. He could very well be.
Now, he was a guy that that was very helpful. He took a good stand on things, and he done some good things around there.
One of the things he did with Tommy was arrange to bail all those people out that were arrested on that.
Yeah, on that Sunday afternoon. Well, I wasn't up there when they gassed that meeting. We come up a few days later. Now, Baloo, I'm sure, was a teacher or something. He had some kind of a post out at that agricultural college out in West Fargo, wherever it's at. And I believe he was one of the speakers. They were having a clam bake or a get-together in the afternoon for the strikers, as I remember that incident. And they were having a regular dinner. And the American Legion and the Fargo's Finest come down and tear gassed the Union Hall. Now that was old 173. And they took a bunch of guys to jail.
About 90 of them.
Yeah, a whole bunch. And a lot of the, I think some of the children and some of the women were nauseated by that tear gas.
Right, and one child was actually had a severe eye injury.
Yes, yes. And there were some other injuries to the children. I panicked more than anything else, and they run into things because they weren't used to that tear gas.
Right.
Well, I think Farrell and I left the left next morning, and we drove up in his car. He had a 31 Chevrolet Coach, and we drove up there. We got ourselves some diggings up there to live. And then we went down and we met with Baloo. Now at that time, he was a man 55 to 60 years old, as I recall.
Right.
And he was very quiet, very soft-spoken, but very firm, very resolute in what he done. And what's more, he was well-known and well-respected by a lot of people. And then we stayed there until we got run out of town. We got chased out of town. I think that's when Farrell and I and Mickey Dunn and Arthur LeSueur had to go over and live in the Comstock Hotel over in Moorhead.
Well, Mickey had actually been chased out earlier, I think.
Well, perhaps, but I know we got it again. It was all living over in the Comstock Hotel.
Okay.
Mickey and I had beds in one room. And
Arthur LeSueur,
I don't know if him and Farrell shared a room or they had rooms of their own. But Mickey and I, maybe we were jungled up together. You know, money was, we didn't have a lot of money them days. Oh, we had enough money to get a room. But remember, 574 was pretty much in the hole, too. We didn't have a lot of money.
But you had to buy gas for your car and you had to...
Well, we had to do that. Oh, we had that kind of money, but we didn't have expense money like they got today.
Right.
So we went up there and then we were forbidden to come into North Dakota. We get arrested. But Mickey and I drove over to the Capitol, that's in Bismarck, and went to the governor's goddamn house for something. We wanted him to sign something for us, and we went right into his goddamn bedroom. And we had a hell of a time to get the paper printed. We had to go to New Rockford, I guess, to get a printer that would print the paper for us. Oh, they had a witch hunt going around there, I want to tell you.
So when you got into the governor's, he was in bed and you got into his bedroom?
Yeah, we walked right in there. And we told him we had a scene that was very urgent. And I don't know if it was his wife or a maid, and well, the governor is there, and we heard him holler. I don't think we made any points with him. What the hell was his name? Moody or something?
Moody.
Huh?
Thomas Moody.
Yeah, well, what kind of a guy was he? I'm trying to think now.
He was a Democrat, and he didn't last in office because he was challenged because he hadn't been a resident of the state long enough.
Huh?
Yeah. Challenge in the Supreme Court.
But I don't know if he was on friendly to us or unfriendly.
Well, he was. I don't know.
Huh?
He hadn't been governor very long. He had just taken office in January.
Yeah, well, we were after him to.
It would have been the latter part of January or maybe the first week of February.
Well, we were after him to call off the dogs there in Fargo.
Right.
We said, this is all nothing doing, raiding the goddamn. And get rid of that fascist atmosphere with the American Legion. You know, they were running roughshod around there.
Now, he did send a telegram, though, to Francis Perkins.
I believe he did. He agreed to do something.
Right.
We didn't think it was as much as he should have done.
I didn't do any good either to send her a telegram.
No.
But he at least did that.
Yeah, well, that's what Judge Padway used to do.
Yeah.
Tobin would send him into a situation and that way you get down and fire off three or four telegrams, give copies of them to the press, and grab the next train out of town. That was an old short con game, you know. They all were practicing it.
Did Farrell come with you to Bismarck?
Huh? No. No.
Wasn't with you.
No, just Mickey and I.
You and Mickey.
Mm-hmm. I believe Farrell might have went with Bill Cruton over to find this printer over in New Rockford. I think they had to go to New Rockford to get the paper printed.
I think you're right. Farrell says in his book, Valley City. But I think New Rockford was the more likely place because there were some friendly people in New Rockford.
Yeah, I think it was New Rockford. As I recall, Valley City's about 60 miles west of Fargo. And then New Rockford, let me think now, that's a little north of there, isn't
north
it?
North and west, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
And it's more up towards the way to Devil's Lake. Yeah. And I think that's where they went to find a printer. Now, they might have went to Valley City. I wouldn't quarrel with it.
Well, I don't know either, but I kind of thought that New Rockford would be the likely place because there was a printer there that was...
I'm sure it was New Rockford, at least.
Yeah.
Where they finally got it printed.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to rule out the fact that they might have went to Valley City.
Yeah, they may have gotten some others printed there at Valley City, too.
Yeah, well, they might have went to Valley City, and the guy turned them down, and they went from there. They just hauled off to the northwest and went into New Rockford.
Yeah.
But I'm stuck with the idea that it was New Rockford.
So, Ballou didn't come with you to Bismarck, though.
Huh?
This guy Ballou didn't come with you to Bismarck.
No, it was just Mickey Dunn and I. We left early in the afternoon. It's about 200 miles across there. Late in the afternoon. And we got there, it took us about 5 hours to get across. The roads weren't the best at all times. No, and it took us 5 or 6 hours to get over there. And I know it was real late when we came back, when we got back.
Did you go back that same day?
Oh, yeah. See, we were under...
You couldn't afford that.
We couldn't afford to be apprehended. And we had to go.
How about Bill Langer? He was down in Fargo then. Was he of any help to you?
Well, I don't remember bumping into Bill Langer. I wouldn't want to say yes or no. I just don't remember any contact with him. Now, I put in there, I believe, in that bundle of papers, I put in there the efforts to get into Omaha and to Des Moines and later on into Fort Dodge, Iowa. Because you'd ask me questions about Des Moines and about Omaha. Yeah, because I knew where I was and what I was doing. And the question in Fort Dodge. majority of British here, they're honest. But they get in a situation and they ain't got no goddamn idea what to do. Well, we had a fellow over there, his name I think was Carl Trebrand.
Trebrand?
T-R-E-B-R-A-N-D. And I think he had been sent down, there were two of them that had been there. The other one was Joe, J-O-E, Pease, P-E-A-S-E. Now, I don't know which one was there at the time. And they got mixed up with Brady. Well, Brady was no place for, there was no place to have a kid out there to do a man's work. Now, I was young, but I knew the industry, and I knew what was going on. And if I didn't, I'd give them an argument anyway. Well, they got in some kind of a mix-up with Brady, and it was no time then, no trouble at all, to get the guys hiked off the job. And that wasn't our bag at that time, really. The hardest thing in the world is go around and tell fellas, don't sign an agreement, don't take a nickel or a dime an hour raise from your employer, we're going to get you more. And they got into a big scrape over there, and I guess, as I remember, the place was all snarled up. So I had to get it in there, and well, I got it straightened out finally, but Brady was going to be happy. Because he was thought he had a way now to lean on us. And it was a ticklish situation. We had more than one of those kind of instances. We had a problem on our hands there for over a year, you know.
There's a reference in the Wallace Short Unionist about you going over to Fort Scott.
Yeah.
And that must be what...
Yeah, I was on the go so goddamn much I can't remember. Yeah, it was in 38. That was in...
There's an article in there that you had gone over there and had signed up Brady or whatever.
Well, we squared him away, yeah. Brady, you know, was a hostile guy.
Yeah.
And, we're still waiting to find out if we're going to affiliate with the CIO. A couple of the bigger locals down Southern California voted 2-1 no. But the smaller locals, it's a sad state today, this labor movement.
Yeah, sure. Jack, my tape is running out.
Okay.
And I'd sure like to talk to you again.
Well, set a date and we'll see.
July is going to be really impossible for me.
All right.
Why don't I write you a letter, Jack?
All right.
Is that okay?
Okay.
And then I'll see how... how are you in August?
Well, I'll be all right.
Are you? Okay.
I'm still alive.
No, you will be.
All right.
And thanks. I'll write you a letter, Jack.
All right.
Okay, thanks a lot.
This is Saturday, May 28th, Seattle, Washington. I plan to tape a discussion with Erling Sanis, Bismarck, North Dakota, concerning the organization of the Teamsters in South Dakota, North Dakota, parts of Iowa, 1937, 1938, 1939, part of 1940.
After you had a chance to take a look,
yep. Hello.
Hold on, I think somebody's calling.
Yeah, all right.
Sorry for that interruption.
That's all right. I know that. I know those phones. I'm hip to them.
It might be worth going into a little more detail than Farrell did in his book.
On what?
On that whole episode.
Well, that has to be carefully done.
Yeah, that's why I say that if...
have to be very careful. There's some things in there that I wouldn't want to disturb unless I really know what the hell the score was.
There isn't anything that's in conflict that I can see, Jack, with what Farrell has already written.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of other details that would really add a lot to what Farrell has written.
Yeah, well, Farrell was writing part for the political world and part for history.
Uh-huh. But he's pretty accurate, though.
Of course he was accurate.
Yeah.
He had a memory, so did I.
Oh, yeah.
And we had the records at the time.
See, what I found in those files, Jack, is this E.G. Coombs, that FBI...
Yeah, he was a son of a bitch. He was the guy in charge, special agent.
And he wrote, I don't know, there are hundreds and hundreds of pages of reports.
Oh, well, he was living down there.
Yeah.
He was staked out. We knew it. He was running around there like a goddamn lapdog trying to get something on somebody.
That's right. And it's all...
Well, you can't live in fear of them bastards. They know they're on your trail. They know they're going to shoot you.
And he sent the original of his report to J. Edgar Hoover. The second copy went to the Assistant Attorney General of the United States. The third copy... various copies went to various places.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you or somebody else were to go now to the FBI under the Freedom of Information Act and ask to get, your file, they would probably delete all of the names other than your name.
Yeah.
But what I found now is the copy that the school sent to the Assistant U.S. Attorney General.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the second copy.
What?
It's the second copy.
Yeah.
There are no names that are completed to see because it's been laying there for 50 years.
Yeah.
And so I made copies of a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I have those copies.
Well, I'd like to see them sometime.
Right. And that's why that if you and I can ever get together, I'd be glad to.
Yeah.
But they're costly to reproduce, and they're just hundreds and hundreds of pages.
Yeah.
And just lots of them. But so sometime we may talk about it, Jack.
I will.
Ever get
I'll keep it in mind.
But now, North Dakota.
Yeah.
I would really like a little information about you working out here in the harvest fields and the IWW days, Jack. You had mentioned that to me once before, that you had spent some time out here in the harvest fields.
Well, I first went out there with my stepdad. I was 15 years old. And we went out by Cando, North Dakota.
Cando, yeah. They're around Devil's Lake.
Yeah. It's a little, I think, north and west of there.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
Right. You're right.
And he was engineering. He was the engineer on a Buffalo Pitts double action steam plant.
Oh.
And I was firing. I was firing for him, and he was the engineer. And we started the season out. And he had worked for this fellow before. And so we got along part of the time in the season, and then we made one place, we thrashed that place out, and I don't think this was a contract thrasher. I think it was one of them change work guys. You know how they used to do it? 8 or 10 farmers would get together and they change work. Well, we made the second move, or we finished the second move, and by God, a boiler, a stay bolt in the boiler on the engine blew out. And there was no way that they could get it repaired. There's no way you could run without with it the way that it was. So we had to give up the steam engine. And they went to town, and they hurried up. They had to now. And they were down a day or two, and they got a big old rumbly oil pull thing. Well, the old man knew nothing about running gas engines. And we stayed and finished the season. And I went to work hauling bundles in, and he went to work as a spike pitcher, if you're familiar with that. And that was the end of my first season there. I was 15 years old, and you come back, you made a couple hundred dollars, you know, in that period of time. And they were pretty decent farmers to work for. Well, the next year, I went out again, but this time I was on my own. I didn't go with the old man, I went with another friend of mine. And we beat our way out on the railroad. And we got to Dilworth, Minnesota. And we met a guy in the jungle there. And he wanted to know if we belonged to the IWW, I believe. And I said no, and he gave us a bunch of paper and everything and told us all about it. Then we got on the railroad train, and we were going more into North Dakota. It was a little early for thrashing, but there was some shocking going on. They didn't pay too much for that. And somewhere along the line on that train around up New Rockford, why I joined the IWW. And they had what they called riding delegates on them trains. These fellows, I don't know if you're familiar with the expression. If they're not, stop me. Well, they call him the riding delegate. Well, he was the guy that had the rigging. He was back in the rigging for the Wobblies. He had books. He could join you up. He had the literature. He had the paper and the books, the song books, and he sold them to you. And he had the stamps. All the Tom Moody stamps, the Sacco and Vanzetti stamps, and Sacco and Vanzetti had just been topped, you know. That was a real popular thing. You had the defense stamps, the education stamps. You bought all of them. They were 2 bits and a dollar. Oh, you could get more, but the stamps were a nominal fee, and you put them in your book. Well, it indicated what kind of a guy you were, I guess. And you paid your dues, and you had the song books. Geez, they only cost a dime. They'd be worth a lot of money today, those old books. And they preached to you and told you what the score was. And that was my first experience on my own in the IWW. And I began to learn a little bit more about it. Now that was I was 16 or 17 years old when I first bumped into them dudes. Now, as you got out into Western Dakota on the Great Northern, those brakemen were pretty hostile. They wanted to know what you were riding on. And they meant if you belonged to the Wobblies or not. Now there was a group of them guys, I understand later I found this out. They were pretty good union men. And they had pulled some kind of a wildcat strike out there in 1920 in that period. And Arthur LeSueur was out and represented them.
It was in Minot.
And he tells quite a story about that. Now, incidentally, his papers are all in the... Pardon me. I have a State Historical Society.
Yeah, right. And
he was quite a guy, you know. His daughter is still alive, Maridel.
Right.
And she's 88 years old, believe it or not.
She's going around speaking, too.
Huh?
She still goes around on speaking engagements.
Yeah, yes.
Giving poetry readings and those.
Yeah. She was going to be in that DFL affair they were going to have there that didn't come off on account of that guy. Well, now that was my first experience up there.
So, did you actually join the IWS?
Oh, yes, at that time. And then they had different groups, you know. That was 120. That was the agricultural workers. And then...
Did they have a local, or an organized, like a hall in New Rochester?
No, no. They were all the work that I ever saw. I think they had a hall or an office in Fargo. I never was in it, but I think they had some kind of an office there. But all the work was carried on by these riding delegates, these delegates that were going back and forth. Now, at one time, they had some kind of a station there in Miles City, Montana, a couple of years later. I was out there working on a pipeline, and they were involved in that. They were around when there was jobs going on. And I got to know them, and I associated with them and belonged to them for several years. I forget what the dues were. They were very nominal.
Now, Harry DeBoer tells me that you maybe know this better than me, but Harry's dad, you know, up there in Crookston, Minnesota, was a farmer. And,
yeah.
And raised horses, did horse trading. And Harry tells me that his dad would not hire a person to work on the farm unless the individual was a member of the IWW.
Well, that's possible.
And that was kind of Harry's introduction to the IWW.
Yeah.
His father, and then Harry's first strike was in North Dakota. Harry struck out up sort of like you when he was a young teenager and went over into the Grand Forks, North Dakota area. And as a member of the IWW, and they went out on a thrashing job. And,
on a what?
They were thrashing for a farmer, and they struck, and they lost the strike because the farmer fired them all, went to town and got a new crew, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Harry said that was the first strike that he participated in, was the IWW strike somewhere in Grand Forks County.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, that's interesting. So, how many years did you do that, Jack, then?
Well, off and on, I probably went out to the harvest fields for 4 or 5 years. And I got involved in construction work. You see, when you would work, they were around any place that they could organize. They were trying. They had them guys around. And I kept the book up in the Wobblies Union, up in the Wobblies, well, more out of sentiment, until about 1935, I believe. But mostly it was for sentiment. But when I was staying in Minneapolis and driving truck, I'd go down to the hall once in a while, but not very often. The driver's union was taking up my time from 34 on. But I'd occasionally go down to the street meetings. Quite often, as a matter of fact, in the summer. There was no street meetings in the winter, you can understand that. And in the winter time, when you were working late, and even if you weren't working late, there wasn't too many meetings that I was attracted to during the winter months in Minnesota. You know, you got through work at 6, 7 o'clock at night, the time you rode a streetcar home, it was 8:30, and you had to get up there early in the morning. There wasn't too many meetings. Oh, I attended a few, on Sundays or things like that. They had a hall down, it was on South Washington, and I'm trying to place where it was. Little hole in the wall, it wasn't no big office. Had a little storefront. But I can't remember exactly what block it was in. It was in between 2nd Avenue, and I don't know what side of 2nd Avenue it was on, either between that and 3rd Avenue, or it was between that and Marquette, but I can't quite remember. I was going to get the old phone book and look it up to see if they had a phone. They might have had a phone, you know. But, no, I was on a job in Miles City, Montana, on Powder River, they called it. They were laying a pipeline, and I got out there, and the mobs were active as hell out there. They were hard-timing them. They didn't pull any strikes, but they were really giving that boss hell. Now, when I was back in Minnesota, this may fit in with, I don't know if it's worth repeating, but the Wobblies did have this. I participated in a couple of those things.
Couple of what?
They had a couple of incidents.
Uh-huh.
There was a thrash machine called the Yellow Fellow, the Separator. And I was on a couple of times where the Wobblies went out and found where there was a Yellow Fellow working, and they tried to get on that job. And I went out with one of them, and I forget where the hell it was, whether it was in South Dakota or North Dakota. I want to think it was around Sisseton, South Dakota, but I'm not sure. And the idea was to go and get big bricks, rocks, 6-7 inches through the middle, take a bundle of whatever grain you were hauling and take the twine off of it, tie it in the inside of another bundle, and put it up in the end so that it was your end of the wagon, because if a spike pitcher would get it, he might not throw it in. And then you throw it into the separator. And the idea was to bust up the cylinders. And they were made by the Avery Manufacturing Company. Now, I understood that from the gossip that the Wobblies had had a beef there with them, whether they had a strike and lost it, or whether they participated in it and were some way disciplined, I don't know. And I thought the Avery Manufacturing Company was in Kansas.
I've heard of that. I've heard that Avery Manufacturing Company, but I can't remember either.
I thought it always was in Kansas. Well, when I come back from Minnesota, when I was giving my explanation of some of the things that happened in my youth with the Wobblies, why, I thought, and I told them that I thought it was in Kansas, but I couldn't remember about it. Well, when I come home, I was reading a couple of things that Frank Lovell had sent me. And among it was a story that Jim Cannon, or not a story, but a report. After the indictments in Minneapolis, I was in prison at the time, and I didn't know it. And it was in the book, I forget the name of the book, Speeches of the Party or something. It was at the Morrison Hotel. Jim Cannon made a remark that this was the third time that he was indicted. This was before the trial. And he said the first time was in 1913, in the spring of 1913, in Peoria, Illinois, at the Avery Manufacturing Company. So I'm sure that's the same thing in the same place, because all those farm machinery places were in that part of the country. The McCormick Reaper, you know, the binder, John Deere, and all those farm machinery, not all, but many of them were made in that part of the country.
You know Franklin Roseland?
Huh?
You know a man by the name of Franklin Roseland, Jack?
Franklin Roseland?
Roseland.
How do you spell it?
R-O-S-E-M-O-N-T.
No, I know a Louis Roseland.
This is Roseland.
No?
Franklin is kind Indiana runs Kerr Publishing Company now.
Oh, that's the big wobbly pit. They're real friendly, you know.
Right. Yeah, they were actually a socialist.
Yeah, they were. They deserve credit for what they published.
Yeah. Now, I was in Chicago a year or so ago, and I visited with Franklin and Rosemont, and he was telling me he has access to a lot of the old wobbly.
A guy could write him.
Yeah.
How do you spell his name?
R-O-S-E-M-O-N-T.
Just a minute. R-O-S?
E-M-O-N-T.
Rosemont,
uh-huh.
M-O-N-T?
M-O-N-T, yeah.
And Frank is his name?
Yeah.
He's with Kerr?
Yep, right.
Well, hell, I know where to write him.
And Franklin was telling me about this matter that you just mentioned about James Cannon and the Peoria, Illinois matter.
Yeah, that was Avery.
He ran across it in some lovely publication that he has there at Kerr.
Yeah.
And it's all written up, and it's pretty old, but it was all pretty well documented. And so, anyway, that's a little kind of a...
Are you knowledgeable with him, or just a chance acquaintance?
Well, I met with him.
Well, what if I would write and tell him in a discussion with you, this question come up, would
right.
that be proper?
Yes, certainly. He remembers me. And
all right, I'll do that.
Mention my name, because he's particularly interested in my Teamsters research, because in that North Dakota paper that I sent you, I have some footnotes on the IWW.
Yeah.
And that's why I asked you about your experiences more in detail, because I'm going to go into more detail when I write.
Yeah.
Some more about North Dakota. And he's particularly interested in these kinds of happenings, you know, because a lot of people think the IWW didn't exist after World War One.
Oh, the hell they didn't. They was active as hell out there.
Yeah.
And if you weren't a member of the Wobblies on that up around Minot there, you had a difficult time. Them brakemen would chase you off the goddamn train.
And so I'm kind of interested, like Cannon was, in this revolutionary continuity.
Well...
Because the IWW does have a place in all of this.
Well, this wasn't revolutionary continuity. That's the book that Farrell wrote. But I don't care much about that book. But,
Anyway, that's why I have an interest in, you know, in trying to get as much information as I can.
Yeah.
About people like yourself that did have some, you know.
Well, I was up in another, in different places where I've been where there were active wobs. Where they engineered their beefs with the boss, and usually it was over food, it was over conditions in the bunkhouses. You know, these guys would scream and holler at the at them. Well, we had some miserable conditions on some of them road jobs. Them old goddamn bunk cars they'd pull around in the mud, you know.
A lot of you did,
I can't hear you now.
A lot of you people that were in the IWW movement in those years, that you got into, like Harry DeBoer got into the Teamsters movement, you did, and, you know, and several others also. And
well, I learned a lot among the Wobblies. I learned some of it in the street meetings. I learned some of it. I learned a lot from them. And I watched them, and I participated in them until, 34, 35, I would say. You know, off and on, I wasn't what you'd call a stalwart member that was there at every meeting.
I guess somebody is calling me, Jack.
Yeah?
My tape has run out.
All right.
Could I talk to you on 211?
Just a minute, let me mark it down. I missed the last one. I was waiting last week. June 11th? Okay. All right.
Same
time. All right. Thanks, Jack. You bet. Hello? This is Seattle, Washington. June 11, 1988. I propose to tape a discussion with Erling Sanis concerning the organization, the Teamsters Union, North Dakota, South Dakota, parts of Iowa, 1937, 38, 39, and 40. Sanis did not call June 11th. I will wait tonight, which is June 18th. He has not written, so I assume he may call tonight at 8 o'clock. If so, the date on this tape will be June 18, 1988, instead of June 11, 1988.
Cannon wrote, transcribe that.
Oh, yeah.
But goddamn able writer.
Oh, yeah, 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 very good.
And he could write with humor. I don't know if I sent you a copy of him and Max Shackman or not.
Sure, I appreciate that, Jack.
Huh?
Yeah, you did send me a copy of that.
Now, I placed that when they were staying at the Summit Hotel in Minneapolis.
Uh-huh.
And that had to be in the late July of 1934.
Shockman's papers are at the Tamament Library.
Yeah, you see, now, I wanted to make one thing that's kind of cleared up. When you asked me about my experiences with the Wobblies in North Dakota,
yeah,
that wasn't my first experience. See, my stepdad was pretty knowledgeable about the Wobblies. He'd been involved in the earlier days when he was bumming around the country. And a lot of his friends had come to the house and they would talk and everything. So I had a little background of the Wobblies long before. But you asked me a specific question about when did I bump into them in North Dakota, as I recall.
I guess I just assumed that was your first contact.
Oh, no, 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 no. No, the old man and some of his friends, there were two or three of them. One was a big old carpenter, a Norwegian carpenter. And he had a funny name, Tiested or something. It started out TJ or something like that. And he was quite a Wobbly himself.
It wasn't T-Bone Slim, was it?
No, it wasn't T-Bone Slim. I don't know about him, who he was, or nobody else seems to know much about him either. Huh?
His name comes up every once in a while.
Yeah, it does. And Jerusalem Slim, his name comes up too.
Oh.
You know who they call Jerusalem Slim?
No.
That was Christ.
Oh.
That's who they call Jerusalem Slim.
Oh.
Yeah, that was a wobbly name for Jesus Christ. When they'd want to talk about Jerusalem Slim, you know what they were talking about.
I see. Have you heard the latest on Joe Hill? I get the Wobbly paper.
I do too. I've got the latest issue out in my truck. I haven't unrolled it yet.
Okay, I won't tell you as long as you have it. There's an article in there about Joel Hill.
Yeah.
They found some of his ashes in the FBI headquarters in Washington.
His ashes?
Yeah. See, when he was executed, he provided in his will that his body would be returned to Chicago and cremated.
Yeah.
And half of his ashes were to be buried in Chicago at that cemetery. And the other half were to be sent to various places in the United States and around the world and so on.
Yeah, somewhere to go to Sweden, I thought.
And apparently the FBI intercepted the envelope that contained a small amount of the ashes like
that. Well, when could that have happened? There was no FBI at the time that he was executed.
Well, it was the Bureau of Investigation, is what it was called then.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's the forerunner of what we call But J. Edgar was running that office too, you know.
Was at the time that Joe Hill was killed?
I can't remember the year that Hill was executed.
No, Christ, no. I don't. Well, I'm not going to argue with you if they said that in the paper.
1915 and 1920, I think.
I don't think he was there that early.
Well,
see, it was they were attached to the Department of Revenue, the Internal Service.
Yeah, but I've got papers in my file. And
well, I'm not going to quarrel if you've got the dope, but I fixed them as being attached to the Bureau of Internal Revenue.
See, I did some work on Kate Richards O'Hare.
Yeah.
You probably remember her, the deaf socialist. And she was sentenced in federal prison here in North Dakota.
Yeah.
For 5 years, and for making a speech out at Bowman.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1917. And at that time, J. Edgar Hoover was in the Bureau of Investigation then.
He was?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Gee, I didn't think he was that old.
Well, he was there.
1916?
Yeah.
He'd have had to been 30 years old then. Was he born that early?
I don't know, Jack. I really don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm just going by. The old son of a bitch had never been born. The job he done on me and the rest of
article in the latest issue, you'll really enjoy that.
Account, yeah.
About how they, you know, they've had these ashes all these years.
Well, so that's not all they got all these years.
Well, Jack, to get back to North Dakota, so you were, came out here the first time with Farrell in January of 35, as I recall, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we drove out together, Farrell and I, in Farrell's car.
But before that, you had mentioned to me something about delivering the first truck of beer to North Dakota.
Yeah, well, Farrell wasn't around then.
Yeah.
I didn't know Farrell.
That would have been in 33 or 34?
1933. Now, I was working at that time for a trucking company, and we were hauling beer out of Schmidt's Beer Brewery in St. Paul. And the brewery, the beer, this contractor, this trucking contractor, had a contract with Valley City Wholesale Grocery. And they also had a hookup in Bismarck. We used to deliver into Bismarck, North Dakota. And we went into Mandan, over across the river there. And where else did we go once? We took a load into Glendive of groceries now. But when beer first come back in April of 1933, we drove a load of beer into Jamestown, North Dakota. And we were going to deliver it there to a grocery company. Now, it was part of the, well, I don't know exactly, I can't recall now, but it was part of the operating apparatus of that Valley City Wholesale Grocery. They operated under, with different things. Well, when the beer would become, there was something in the state of North Dakota that they had to have a special session like they did in many states to handle that. Now, it was illegal to transport beer. As I recall, they told us it was illegal to transport beer in the state of North Dakota. That is, you couldn't unload it there. You could haul it through and everything. You could have all you wanted. Well, here we were. We had this, and the high sheriff come down, and he informed the grocery company that if they attempted to unload that truck, he would arrest them. Well, they told us to go to a hotel, and there was a couple of Greek restaurants there in Jamestown. We went over one on the railroad tracks there on the main street. There was a trucking company there, Schneider, I guess, was the name of it. And we went over there, and we said, where's a good place to eat? And they told us to go over, and we went and got a room in a hotel. We ate, and we went back to the truck, and it was parked alongside the street, on out in front of this wholesale house, this grocery warehouse. And we told them they wanted to know where we were, and we told them what hotel we were going to be in. Well, a couple of hours we went up and we went to sleep. We'd driven out from Minneapolis. It had taken us 12, 14 hours to get out there. And we'd been fooling around there for a couple of hours in the morning. Now, this was after dinner already, about around noon or after dinner. And a guy, they put a call in for us, for one of us to come over. So I went over, told my partner, you stay here, you sleep, I'll go over and see what's going on. Well, I went over and they asked me if I could back the truck up alongside of the warehouse. I said, sure. So I backed it in and I parked it. And then they proceeded to get some carpenters. And they built a kind of a lean-to with 2x4s and that corrugated metal or plywood or something. And they built a shed around that truck. And they said, now this is our warehouse. And that's the way they unloaded that first load of beer there. Yeah, that's the way they got around it. Yeah, they built a goddamn thing. You see, it was legal to have the beer on the... So we unloaded. And when we got unloaded, we started back for the city. And we stopped and picked up some cream for... Bridgman Russell Cream, and we took it into, I guess it was Holmes Dairy in St. Paul. And by the time, when we got back in, we didn't get any more beer. We got a letter for a load of condiments for the Jimtown Nut House. They got a giggle factory out there. They've got an insane asylum or something in Jamestown. So we brought out a load of condiments, about 12 ton of jelly and from, what the hell was it, Wheeler Manufacturing or something there on Hiawatha Avenue. So it was a week or 10 days before we got another load of beer to go out there. And in the meantime, they'd got something straightened around and we didn't have any more trouble. And that's the saga of the first load of beer that I know about in the Jimtown, North Dakota. I think it was the first load.
I'm sure you're right, John.
Huh?
I'm sure you're right.
Now, I can't tell you exactly what time that was. It was in the early spring, May, or whatever. But that's what I remember about that. And that's just about the way I recall it. They made a little lean-to around the goddamn truck, so it wasn't out in the open. Didn't take the carpenters long to nail a goddamn make a 2x4. You know, our truck was only 35, 40 feet long, and all we had to do was stick up 15, 20 pieces of plywood with some 2x4s, and that was all locked in. Well, we had a full load, I imagine. We probably had 10, 12 ton. We had a full load on. 24,000, maybe at least. Now, those days, you could only haul a certain amount of weight. And I think the frost boil law was still on. You could only have a certain amount of weight. You know, the frost boil law, you know about that. You only could have a certain amount of weight at that time of the year. No, it was in May. It couldn't have been. But we had everything we could get on that rig.
What was the name of the firm that you were driving for?
Well, I think it was Black Hawk Motor Freight is what they called it.
Black Hawk
Motor.
Now to get back to Fargo on 35, then January 35. You ever remember a man by the name of William Ballou, Jack?
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me about him?
You're talking about the old professor?
Well, I think he was a Unitarian minister.
Was a minister? But I thought wasn't his name Scott Ballou?
William is what I have.
Yeah, well, that's probably it. He was,
Farrell mentions him in one of the books, but Farrell had forgotten.
Yeah, wasn't he a teacher out there at West Fargo School of, ain't there an agricultural school out there someplace?
Agricultural college, yeah.
I thought he was teaching out there.
That could be. His wife was a
Sunday afternoon. But I wasn't up there when they gassed that meeting. We come up a few days later. Now, Ballou, I'm sure, was a teacher or something. He had some kind of a post out at that agricultural college out in West Fargo, wherever it's at. And I believe he was one of the speakers. They were having a clam bake or a get-together in the afternoon for the strikers. As I remember that incident. And they were having a regular dinner. And the American Legion and the Fargo's Finest come down and tear gas the Union Hall. Now that was old 173. And they took a bunch of guys to jail.
About 90 of them.
Yeah, a whole bunch. And a lot of the, I think some of the children and some of the women were nauseated by that tear gas.
Right, and one child was actually had a severe eye injury.
Yes, yes. And there were some other injuries to the children. I panicked more than anything else, and they run into things because they weren't used to that tear gas. Well, I think Farrell and I left the left next morning, and we drove up in his car. He had a 31 Chevrolet coach, and we drove up there. We got ourselves some diggings up there to live. And then we went down and we met with Ballou. Now at that time, he was a man 55 to 60 years old, as I recall.
Right.
And he was very quiet, very soft-spoken, but very firm, very resolute in what he done. And what's more, he was well-known and well-respected by a lot of people. And then we stayed there until we got run out of town. We got chased out of town. I think that's when Farrell and I and Mickey Dunn and Arthur LeSueur had to go over and live in the Comstock Hotel over in Moorhead.
Well, Mickey had actually been chased out earlier, I think.
Well, perhaps, but I know we got it again. We was all living over in the Comstock Hotel. Mickey and I had beds in one room. And
Arthur
LeSueur, I don't know if him and Farrell shared a room or they had rooms of their own. But Mickey and I, maybe we were jungled up together. You know, money was, we didn't have a lot of money them days. Oh, we had enough money to get a room, but remember 574 was pretty much in the hole too. We didn't have a lot of money.
But you had to buy gas for your car and you had to...
Well, we had to do that. Oh, we had that kind of money, but we didn't have expense money like they got today.
Right.
So we went up there and then we were forbidden to come into North Dakota. We get arrested. But Mickey and I drove over to the Capitol, that's in Bismarck, and went in the governor's goddamn house for something. We wanted him to sign something for us, and we went right into his goddamn bedroom. And we had a hell of a time to get the paper printed. We had to go to New Rockford, I guess, to get a printer that would print the paper for us. Oh, they had a witch hunt going around there, I want to tell you, Early.
So when you got into the governor's, he was in bed and you got into his bedroom?
Yeah, we walked right in there. And we told him we had a scene, it was very urgent. And I don't know if it was his wife or a maid, and the governor is there, and we heard him holler. And Mickey said he had the guts of a road agent too, you know. And he said, we'll go right up. And up we went. He was in bed in the second floor, and we were telling him, and I don't think we made any points with him. What the hell was his name? Moody or something?
Moody.
Huh?
Thomas Moody.
Yeah, well, what kind of a guy was he? I'm trying to think now.
He was a Democrat, and didn't last in office because he was challenged because he hadn't been a resident of the state long enough.
Huh?
Yeah. Challenged in the Supreme Court.
But I don't know if he was on friendly to us or unfriendly.
Well, he was, I don't know.
Huh?
He hadn't been governor very long. He had just taken office in January.
Yeah, well, we were after him to,
It would have been the latter part of January or maybe the first week of February.
Well, we were after him to call off the dogs there in Fargo.
Right.
We said, this is all nothing doing, raiding the goddamn, and get rid of that fascist atmosphere with the American Legion. You know, they were running roughshod around there.
Yeah. Now, he did send a telegram, though, to Francis Perkins.
I believe he did. He agreed to do something.
Right.
We didn't think it was as much as he should have done.
I didn't do any good either to send her a telegram.
No.
But he at least did that.
Yeah, well, that's what Judge Padway used to do.
Yeah.
Tobin would send him into a situation and that way he'd get down and fire off three or four telegrams, give copies of them to the press, and grab the next train out of town. That was an old short con game, you know. They all were practicing it.
Did Farrell come with you to Bismarck?
Huh? No. No.
Wasn't with you.
No, just Mickey and I.
You and Mickey.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I believe Farrell might have went with Bill Cruton over to find this printer over in New Rockford. I think they had to go to New Rockford to get the paper printed.
I think you're right. Farrell says in his book, Valley City. But I think New Rockford was the more likely place because there were some friendly people in New Rockford.
Yeah, I think it was New Rockford. As I recall, Valley City's about 60 miles west of Fargo. Ask me questions. we had a fellow over there, his name I think was Carl Treebrand.
Treebrand?
T-R-E-B-R-A-N-D. And I think he had been sent down, there were two of them that had been there. The other one was Joe, J-O-E, Pease, P-E-A-S-E. Now I don't know which one was there at the time. And they got mixed up with Brady. Well, Brady was no place to have a kid out there to do a man's work. Now, I was young, but I knew the industry, and I knew what was going on. And if I didn't, I'd give them an argument anyway. Well, they got in some kind of a mix-up with Brady, and it was no time then, no trouble at all to get the guys hiked off the job. And that wasn't our bag at that time, really. The hardest thing in the world is go around and tell fellas, don't sign an agreement, don't take a nickel or a dime an hour raise from your employer, we're going to get you more. And they got into a big scrape over there, and I guess, as I remember, the place was all snarled up. So I had to get him in there, and well, I got it straightened out finally, but Brady was going to be happy because thought he had a way now to lean on us. And it was a ticklish situation. We had more than one of those kind of instances. We had a problem on our hands there for over a year, you know.
There's a reference in the Wallace Short Unionist about you going over to Fort Scott Dodge.
Yeah.
And that must be what...
Yeah, I was on the go so goddamn much I can't remember. Yeah, it was in 38. That was in...
There's an article in there that you had gone over there and had signed up Brady or whatever.
Well, we squared him away, yeah. Brady, you know, was a hostile guy. And he was a big Irishman, brass-nosed bastard, and he was going to try to push people around. Well, we all didn't push too easy, and we let him know about it. And he had another fellow there, too, and his name was actually Charlie McCarthy. And that was Edgar Bergen's dummy, you know.
Yeah.
You remember Charlie McCarthy and Edgar Bergen? So I made some flip remarks to him, and I thought we were going to go to Duke City there for a minute. He got kind of wise, and he didn't want to indicate, but I let him know about it. I told him what he could do, you know. You've got to shoot your best shot sometimes, even if you get dumped doing it.
You know, Jack, you mentioned Charlie McCarthy. In the National Labor Relations Board files in the National Archives for this period, the 1930s, in one box there is a Charlie McCarthy. What I want to call him, not a doll, but the figure. About 12, 14 inches high.
Yeah?
In a box. There's no reference to where it came from, how it got there, why it's there.
A doll?
Well, you know, I say a doll, I mean it's a, you know, a figure of Charlie McCarthy.
Oh, a dummy.
A dummy, yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, all right.
Do you have any idea why that, did you ever hear Charlie McCarthy had anything to do with labor movement?
No, no. Unless the Screen Actors Guild got after Edgar Bergen, I don't know.
I don't know, but it's in the National Labor Relations Board files there.
You know, just to change the subject and burn up a little time, they beat back that right-wing group in the Screen Actors Guild the other day. Yeah, them. You know them guys that are writing them big popular shows right now, they want to get back to work, that L.A. Vice and a couple of more. But they went 3-1 against them. They had the producers thought they had the thing broken. But we're still waiting to find out if we're going to affiliate with the AFL-CIO. A couple of the bigger locals down in Southern California voted 2-1 no. But the smaller locals, it's a sad state today, this labor movement.
Yeah, sure. Jack, my tape is running out.
Okay.
And I'd sure like to talk to you again.
Well, set a date and we'll see.
July is going to be really impossible for me.
All right.
Why don't I write you a letter, Jack?
All right.
Is that okay?
Okay.
And then I'll see how... how are you in August?
Well, I'll be all right.
Are you? Okay.
I'm still alive.
Oh, you will be.
All right.
And thanks. I'll write you a letter, Jack.
All right.
Okay, thanks a lot.